here for us today. His name is John McDyess. John was actually a professor here for 26 years, is that right?
Yeah, 25.
25 years, taught undergraduate and graduate students. He actually came to the country years and years ago, was an architecture student in Budapest, Hungary, and came over here through a program, and found himself, he got his degree from Miami, Ohio. He's got his architecture degree, and actually over the years helped beef up that school's program to where it is today. Started his practice at SOM, worked there for about 3 years, and realized that even though he was working at one of the most prominent architecture firms in the country, he didn't know how to build a building. So he left the practice of architecture for a few years and went to work for a contractor and learned how to actually construct buildings. And then after that, went on, had his own practice for many years, eventually then joined up with OWP&T, another that's still a prominent architecture firm in Chicago today. And in his day, was probably the premier residential multi-story architect in the city of Chicago, probably Midwest. Knew more about building those types of structures than anyone. He's designed hundreds of millions of dollars worth of structures, but also teaches, so he understands the balance between each. And what John's going to talk to us today about is running your practice, what you need to know about some of the economics. So this is some real-world things that you guys can take into when you get out there, whether you decide to hang your own shingle, whether you go work for a small firm. You can understand what your boss and the partners are going through when they need to make ends meet. Or even if you're a large firm, what kind of goes into those type of ideas as far as economics. So I will leave it to John to tell you about a little bit more about himself and to go through. And again, any questions that come up. This is a good lecture in the sense that it's, you know, we've talked a lot about legal things thus far. Now we're kind of getting into the nuts and bolts of running a practice. So please feel free to ask questions during the course of John's discussions. Maybe he'll have some good helpful stories for you as well.
Thank you.
Go ahead and start the tape.
Well, good morning.
Hey, John. Go ahead and start the machine.
I did.
Oh, you did? Okay.
Yeah. Sure. Let me make sure I did.
All
right. The light is on.
Yeah, you're good.
Well, the one thing I did right. Anyhow, I used to teach here. Those were wonderful years. You might know the name from the housing book. Any of you have seen, I wrote a book called Housing. It's out of print. Maybe it's still available. Anyhow, the lecture today is going to deal with, you know, how to manage your practice. It's really not different than managing your household. You have to know what's coming in, what's going out, and when. And if you know those two things, you don't have to listen to me. I'll let you go home. That's almost as simple, though. Let's take a typical small office, okay? And if you can look at the numbers there, I want to assure you that the accuracy of these numbers is totally unimportant. It's the theory of behind it. First of all, a small office, the likelihood is that you will eventually have your small office, or you work for a small office, and even a large office is no different. First of all, you have production costs. Okay? The production cost of the payroll includes what? Includes the principals, includes the associates, the junior architects, draftsmen, people from school. All of that is your office expense. But you cannot ever forget that when you add this up, you have to add to it Social Security, or FICA, and you have to include health insurance. When the three are put together, payroll, Social Security, and health insurance. In this particular case, $650,000, we are talking about an 8-person office, from principal to associates, junior people. That does not include secretarial help. That means 2,080 hours per year, or if you divide it, you're talking about 16,640 hours, or something like $39 an hour. That's to produce the drawings. But you have other expenses. We call it overhead. Overhead includes everything in the office which does not produce direct architecture product. What are they? Big offices have a receptionist. Most offices have a secretary. You have rent to pay unless you are in your own building. You have professional liability insurance, which is extremely, extremely important. You have all kinds of other insurance. You might have automobiles. You have printing costs. You have telephone bills, fax expenses, utilities, supplies. You have legal fees. You can't exist without good attorneys. You have an accountant you have to pay, and miscellaneous others. We are coming to about $22 an hour overhead. So if I take the roughly $40 an hour direct production and add to it the $22, we are talking about $62 an hour production cost. That includes no profit. You have to add profit to it. Most books, most theories say that you should add 20% profit. We know that no architect I know of makes 20% profit. Interestingly enough, at OWPNP, where we did very well, we made a little bit over 8% profit. In my own office, I used to make about 6% profit. But for the theory, to estimate, you're at 20%. You never make it. But put in your hope. So we are talking about $75 an hour. What does that mean from the client's point of view? 75 bucks an hour. Legible? Okay. In order to sustain this office, you need money. You need clients to pay. You have a production cost right on the top. You have overhead. That's $1,020 divided by 12. That's $85,000. 1,020,000. I'm sorry. Divided by 12 months. That means $85,000 a month. Okay. If you add the 20% profit, you are talking about $100,000 a month. In order to generate $102,000 a month, you are talking about $1,224,000 total fee. But we haven't talked about structural engineers, mechanical and electrical engineers, and maybe spec consultant. We're talking about your architectural office. You need these associates. My experience, and the general experience in the Chicago area, on not just on housing, but on any job, that the consultants, structural and mechanical, take about 35% of the fee. So when you have your own cost and profit is $1,224,000, you have to, that represents 65%. You have to add 35% for your engineers. That means you have $1,883,000 fees to collect a year to stay in business. It's frightening.
Now, one thing you need to understand is when you're out practicing, this fee that we have listed here for consultants, you are normally not going to, when you're running your own shop, normally are not going to have on your full-time payroll someone who's a mechanical engineer, an electrical engineer, especially HVAC. You're not going to have them as on your staff full-time. You will be retaining them on behalf of the owner. Very rarely do you find the owner having contracts with four or five different architects and engineers, especially when you're in a small shop. They will come to you and say, design me this office building, design me this residential space, and then it's your responsibility to get all the consultants underneath. So when we're talking about the revenue that you need to generate, you will be writing the checks to these subconsultants. They will be in contract with you as the architect. And when we get later down into our classes, we'll start talking a little bit more about the difference between the owner architect agreement and the architect consultant agreement. So as a planning model, when you start thinking about the first page that we saw, the revenue that you're going to generate and those costs, which come into the roughly $1.2 million, that's based strictly on architectural services that you will be needing to generate to carry your business. But because you will be required to hire these consultants, you'll need to make sure you generate another $650,000 worth of revenue. Now that's done in a variety of ways. You can pass those fees on a one-to-one basis. So if you get billed by the electrical engineer $1,000, you just pass that bill on to the owner for $1,000. Sometimes you can pass that on with a markup, 10%, 15%, but that's all part of your negotiation between the architect and the owner. But if you think about the logistics of running the business, you get a bill from the engineer, the electrical engineer, for $1,000. Your bill to the owner doesn't go out for another 30 days. So you still need to pay that electrical engineer with money out of your own pocket. The owner then pays you 30 days later. So there's at a minimum a 60-day lag from when you need to pay your consultants to when you get money from the owner. So that's why when you start to think about the model of being able to support the business, while some costs are passed through, you still need to recognize the revenue generation and the stream that happens to get to this $1.8 million.
He raised a very interesting point. Architects are really not beyond being tempted, okay? You get paid from the client your total fee, and a third of it goes to the engineers. Many architects in Chicago, I won't mention ever names, hold on to that money as long as they can before they pay the engineers. That is the worst sin, short of cheating on a building, an architect can commit, because eventually no engineers will want to work for him. We have a strict rule in our office that within 24 hours, we paid our consultants, both the structural and mechanical. Now that develops a relation which is invaluable. I used to tell my engineers, look, the day I get paid, within 24 hours, you get paid. If I don't ever collect, you won't collect either. You have this wonderful relation. They go along with you because they know you. You are going to be honest in their counting. I always knew in practice one or two architects who sat on the consultant's money to use it. Use it for months, 4 months, 5 months. I mean, it's an immoral thing to do. And eventually, no structural engineer will want to work for you. But if you honest with them, they are going to really love to work with you. And their cooperation is essential, especially for instance, in my field. The structural engineer gets in extremely early. He and the soil consultant help decide the foundation system. I mean, they are way beyond friendship. They are absolute necessity. Anyhow.
Let me add one more thing to that, John.
Sure.
So if you take a look at the concept here that we're talking about in his office, that he had a practice of 24 hours, and I will say that's extraordinary and why he was successful for as many years as he was. But you will find common when you enter into contracts with owners that in the contract that you get, that you sign, will have what's called a pay-when-paid clause. And it says the owner will demand this of you because here's the thing. While in running your business, you want to make sure that you have a good relationship with your consultants so you can use them job after job after job. And if you're paying them on time or quickly, they will do your work before someone who doesn't pay them as quickly. So you're always in the right position for the success of your business. The owner, though, when he's thinking about his one building that he's putting up, wants to also make sure that he gets the best service. And knowing that sometimes architects or contractors will hold that money longer than necessary, we'll put this pay with pay clause in, and it will say, architect, within 7 days of you receiving a check from me, owner, you must pay your subconsultants. And the failure of you to follow that 7-day requirement puts you, as an architectural firm, in jeopardy of being in breach of contract. So the owners will want to protect themselves and make sure everybody's paid downstream. They don't want to get liens on their properties. So this will be a common clause that you will see in your contracts. But again, if you have to make payments within 7 days, you have to make sure you're generating the right revenue, you back to the numbers up here. So the last thing I'll say is, when you're working, and this is a recent change in the law in the last 3 or 4 years, when you're working with the city of Chicago, this pay-when-paid 7-day mandate clause is not in every contract. It's something that you, as we've talked a little bit about, contracts are agreements between parties. You can put whatever agreements you want to put in there, as long as they're not in violation of statutes and the Constitution as we went through the hierarchy. In this instance, though, the city of Chicago statutorily has mandated that its projects must all follow the 7-day rule. So if you get a job with the city of Chicago, as we sit today, you will be see that clause no matter what. It may not be in your other private contracts, but certainly with the city of Chicago.
I don't know about the city of Chicago today, but I used to do a good deal of work for the city of Chicago, and it was a great contact, but usually you had to allow 5 to 6 months to collect. I am sure that is not unusual today. Anyhow, we'll get to that. But let's take the next issue, which is the production schedule. It's not a sacred schedule. It's just an assumption. We assumed a job of $600,000 fee, $200,000, about a third, goes to the consultant, mechanical structural engineer, leaving $400,000 for you to produce. The one thing you have to do is what I call a payment schedule or production chart. As you know by now, hopefully you do, that Every job is divided into phases. Schematic design and design development, or just schematic design alone, and then design development and construction documents, which has the working drawings and specs. And then there is the bidding and negotiation period. And finally, there is the construction. And this typical example, I put down the duration of each. Schematic design, maybe a couple of months. Design developments, ditto. Construction documents, maybe 4 months. 1 month for bidding, and 12 months for construction. This is kind of an ideal schedule. It hardly ever happens. It happens in good times. In difficult times, not so. Anyhow, what you have to do, you have to have a chart, like a calendar, and mark the phases of the work, whether it's you do it on a piece of paper or an actual calendar, I don't care how, but you do that. And you plug in when the amounts are due. So if the schematic design takes 2 months, end of 2 months you plug in what is coming to you then. Then design development, say, another month, you plug it then. That's one way to plug it in. That's the ideal world. Doesn't happen. Hardly ever happens. Clients like to take advantage of you. Keep that in mind. It's like walking into the forest, and there are a lot of dogs. You have to assume they all bite. That's my opinion about mostly housing clients. Don't forget, housing clients, people who develop housing, private apartment buildings. And maybe to introduce a little bit to you, I've done a lot of apartment buildings on Lakeshore Drive, 1500, 11, 10, 12, 40, and my favorite is the Harbor House at Belmont and Sheridan. Anyhow, clients are slow in paying. So when you plug in the calendar, say, end of a phase, you have $20,000 or $40,000 due. You have to have another chart. The chart of realism, knowing that this is when you bill the guy. He's not going to pay you at best in a month, maybe 2 months. Sometimes you have to plug in the waiting time 3 or 4 months. Well, how can you survive that without having some kind of cash flow from previous work, having a rich spouse? That helps, right? Or rich parents, or somehow somebody to support your operation. You can manage it on your own and be very proud of. I always manage it on my own. But I realized early on that you cannot be an unmitigated bastard. Your clients have real problems. A developer has, not by nature being a bad person. He's not a bad person. He's just a hungry person who wants to make money. You know, in capitalism, that's not only a sin, it's a great merit. The big problem is that the poor developer depends on times and market, which he has no control. So if the market is slow, he is going to be slow, and he's going to use everybody's money. The lawyers will get that paid on time, the architects. What I am proposing, that you prepare yourself for this reality. That depending on, in my entire practice, I had two clients who were very upset. if I didn't get the bill within 5 days of the billing time, and I usually got paid in 2 additional days. I mean, but those are the rarities. And one of them was a millionaire, and the other was a really, very honorable developer. Anyhow.
Let me add a couple of things to that.
Yes.
So that he is right. I mean, I get an occasional client that wants their bills sent right away, but that's the rarity. And so when you look at the chart that John had up there as far as the timing, that's initially based on, do you want to pull that back up there real quick, the last slide? That's initially based on a 2-year project of how much time you would be spending on doing the work. But as he's talking about, you calendar in running your business, you need to think about two things. I'm an architect and I'm designing and I need to hit these schedules. And in fact, it's not uncommon for your contract to provide a schedule like this to the owner so he knows when he or she's expected to get SDs or DDs, when they're supposed to be getting these deliverables. And that's the operating parameters that you're going under. But the second schedule or chart that you're keeping to run your business says that after 2 months, you make sure that you have billed the initial $30,000 for the work you've done, recognizing that it's going to be a lag before you get paid. So as you're charting out, whether you're opening your first shingle and you have your first 2 clients, you've maybe worked for a firm for a little bit, and now you're going on your own and you're taking 2 or 3 clients with you, or you're going to work for a firm that's small but they want you to be active and involved, you recognize that there's the, as what we're calling, the production schedule, when you're producing the deliverables. And then there's the billing and the ultimate collection schedules. And that's how you make sure you keep your doors open.
Okay. Let's assume a job. You're lucky enough, you've got the job, and assume a $12 million construction cost of an apartment building and a fee of 4%. From my practice, I can tell you in advance, without doing a line of thinking, that it's not enough. Why is it not enough? Well, let's say 4% fee would be $480,000, right? Mechanical engineer and structural engineer, the two of them get a third of your fee. The structural gets usually 12.5% or in that vicinity. The mechanical gets about 22%. Assume a spec writer, you don't write your own specs, for $4,000, and coordinating the engineers allow some time and money for you. You have to spend time with the engineers. That time has to be compensated. It's not a donation, okay? Add 20% profit, at least, to produce the job, $205,000. Divide the $205,000 by $61 an hour, which remember from the previous chart, allows you 3,344 hours to produce. Is that enough? Is it not? It sounds like a lot of time. I mean, you know, when I did my first building or two, I got so excited when I figured out, you know, how much time I have, plenty of time. That turned out to be bullshit. you never have plenty of time. Because if I assume certain production hours, say assume 1%, 8 weeks for schematic design, for two people, 4 weeks. It's not a lot of time. Design development, the same. Construction document, phase 3 persons, 16 weeks. 1 person for bidding and negotiation. And construction, 3/4% per person for 52 weeks. Now, you don't quarter the people, but, you know, they don't spend full time. Turns out to be that it allows you 4,600 hours minus 3,344. The shortage is 1,256 hours. Well, if there is 1,200 hours which is not being paid, you are in serious trouble. So, what can you do? You cannot improve your own production. You have to increase the fee. And if you increase the fee to 6%, you are talking about $720,000 for fee. Deduct from it the structural, mechanical. By the way, on the structural, I discovered some arithmetic problems. It's not 50, it's 90,000. The mechanical is not 150, but 158,000. After that, the figures are correct, except the end, obviously, is not to produce the job, $286,000 left, which $286,000 divided by $61.30 an hour gives 4,066 hours, not 5,256, which is almost enough, but not quite. The lesson of this charting is that 4% fee in an apartment building is not doable. And 6% fee is barely doable. Actually, the architect's fee, I always maintain, should be 7%. Nobody will pay that on apartment buildings. It's a very tight market. All clients try to chisel you. It's not a nice word to use, but they are trying to chisel you, because the less you charge, more they get.
One of the things that you're going to find when you're out there, frustratingly, me having an architecture degree and then becoming a lawyer for a number of reasons, but working with architects over and over, is owners consistently undervalue your services and your time. I think you'll find when you're out in the world, you'll recognize and come to the realization that the contractors are going to make more money per job than you will. And for whatever reason that has come down in the construction and industry, if you take a look at the hierarchy of the contractors, the developers are going to make the most money. Then the actual, your subconsultants, your specialty electrical and structural and mechanical engineers, will make more money than you will on a profit basis. For whatever reason, the owners will consistently recognize that those reasons are necessary, and as a result, when you hire your mechanical or structural electrical engineer, they too will recognize that and pass a higher percentage, or their billable rate will have a higher percentage built into that hourly rate to you. So you find yourself often in the middle between getting, I won't say overbilled by the subconsultants, because they are properly valuing their services, and the owner wanting to pay you less than what you are worth, and so you have to figure out when you're building this model, how many hours do you have to build into the job? What's the value of your fee? what will the cost that you're carrying downstream from your consultants that you have to pick up, that you may be able to bill all of it or not? How do you capture that in your negotiations? And so what John's talking about in this model, per se, this between 4 and 6% analysis, is our real-world numbers when you're doing, in what John did primarily was residential housing, multi-unit, multi-family housing. Commercial will be the same thing. If you're going to be doing commercial buildings, you're going to be looking at fee structures that are well under 10%. If you get into simply doing single-family or small residential units, you may be able to generate between an 8 and 12% fee, depending on the design detail, name recognition, the client, the number of those things. But, as one can imagine, if you're only doing a single-family home, to generate your $1.8 million to operate your 8-person shop, you have to do a lot more single-family homes at a higher percentage, so your volume is higher, versus getting the commercial or the residential structures, the large multi-unit residential structures, where your fee is lower, but your percentage is lower, but your ultimate dollars in are higher. And so what we're trying to show here in these two schedules are some, I won't say real-world numbers because we don't have an actual project here to look at, but these are not uncommon concepts when you take a project that's a $10 million or $12 million project and you start to map out what your fees are. As a guide, when you're out there, again, if you hang your own shingle or go to work for a small shop, you can look at these numbers to say, wow, we're bidding against three other architects. Where are we going to come in on our fee rate to make sure that we're competitive, but we still have to keep the lights on?
Well, it's an interesting issue, and we'll talk about it next time about it, but you know, where do you come in? The owner, this really happened. The owner wanted us to do a hotel in Wisconsin. And I go up there, and we had a meeting date. And as I walk in, my friend, another architect, is walking out. And he says, John, let's have coffee after it. So that would be great. So when I walk out, third guy, also a friend, is walking in. So I said, join us for coffee. And we agreed that we are not going to let this bastard screw us. We are going to collude. This is illegal, by the way. But if nobody finds out, it's not illegal. We agreed that each of us will quote 6% fee to be paid in such increments and let the client decide whose work do they like more. There were three good architects. One was from IIT, myself, and the third guy, I don't remember the name anymore. Guess which one of us got the job? You know, we agreed in a 6% fee. The fourth architect who proposed 5.5%. You know, and 0.5% was not really a significant amount. But developers are very different animals than we are. The more they get their claws into you, the happier they are. I have met some very good people, developers, but the typical, I'm not talking about the city of Chicago. I am not talking about industrial clients. I am not talking about institutional clients like I had the University of Chicago, who are strictly gentleman business basis, but the developer of apartment buildings is a gambler. He really is gambling that the market will hold up. Many times it doesn't. 11 Lakeshore Drive, Malibu East, you know, the 45-story high-rise apartment building, which I was the architect on, has 500 units. That was a very risky thing to throw on the market, 500 units, and market them certainly within a year. Well, Dunbar Builders, who was the client, made a mistake. After they sold about 350 units, the market took a dive. I don't remember why the president had a fart or whatever. He was hospitalized with. The market took a serious dive and nothing sold after that. How did I find that out? Developers don't advertise or talk about difficulties. You know, they're all eminently and constantly successful. I got a call shortly after the building was finished that they cannot open the lobby door. The air pool through the vertical shaft, which is a stair and elevator, is so strong. I said, why should there be? So I got a mechanical engineer, not the one who did the building. I wanted a different one, Harry Nachman, who was the dean of mechanical engineers in Chicago, to come with me. So we take the elevator up to the penthouse, and what do we find? Every apartment building has two huge fans to push air into the corridor, to supply air, because each apartment exhausts air to the toilet, bathroom, and this is called makeup air. Well, after he sold 350 units, and he still had to have 150 himself, the developer says, have to cut operating costs. So he turned off one of the fans. Huge electricity bill saved, but created this terrible updraft and couldn't open the lobby door. A strong man couldn't open it. So we turned the fan back on, immediately the problem was solved. So you never know what happens, but the developer is a very interesting phenomenon. You respect him because if you are in a housing practice, he's going to be likely to be your client. Most housing is built by these hungry bastards who really want to exploit everybody, but we would not be in business without them. So, you know, it's like walking through a forest. You make sure that no wild animal will catch you, or if you see one, you better have a gun and know how to shoot. In all my practice, I had maybe two or three clients who paid on time. I received gifts from them when the job was finished. I mean, they treated me royally. Most of the developer clients, and we are talking about that market, any of you studied Latin? What? No. I wanted to tell you a Latin proverb, but I won't. The English translation is, this is from Rome, when Rome was fighting the Greeks, because it says, beware of the Greeks, even if they bring presents. And, you know, beware of developers, because you need them, You're making your living on servicing them. You will do your very best for them. But beware, they bite.
Okay. And then to kind of bring this back to what we've been talking about in contracts, and as we spent quite a bit of time last week on agency. Yes, the developers are out there, and I have some developer clients. Sadly, the ones that I like the best aren't working right now because the market's tough and they weren't tough enough. So the guys that are out there that are the hungry sharks, the ones that can still keep their doors open, although there's many of those that aren't working right now either. But when you are employed by the developers, who are the people that are going to be paying a lot of your bills, if you're in that market, you're doing commercial real estate, commercial architecture, residential architecture, large-scale residential architecture. Contractually, as we talked about last week, one of your roles will be acting as the owner's agent. And so when you're out there performing your services, you are acting on the developer's behalf. There will be certain contractual obligations that we'll talk about in classes upcoming that you will perform on behalf or as a voice of the owner slash developer here. So when you are out there, you know, you can't really pick your clients by and large. Some architects get to that status, but by and large you can. You need to recognize the balance between, as John says, the bastards, but also recognizing that they're the ones who keep your lights on. So it's a tough thing. I know when I was in architecture school, we never had a class like this to kind of talk about some of the real world issues of going out and practicing and what you're going to run into. But this is something that you'll want to keep close to the forefront of your mind when you're out there, young and starting out, especially in the smaller shops, when these types of things are really coming after you, that it's a day-to-day issue. Just think about your relationship with the client, whether they're the best payers, whether they're too aggressive on the negotiation of your fees and those types of things. Remember, you're going to be wearing the agency hat for them, and they're the ones that are going to be keeping the business.
You'll continue after a break. I'm done for the first part.
Okay, we'll take a short break then. If you guys want to take a break.
Okay, how about 10 minutes?
And we'll be out early today.
How do you know? Maybe I talk forever. Oh. Should I turn it off? Yeah.
About some of the numbers and some of the ways that we talked about as far as the economics of the business. Probably not, but if you do have anything, let us know. One thing that I would say also, that chart that talked about the breakdown between schematic phase, design development, construction documents, the bidding and negotiation, and construction administration. Those percentages, when you do, and we'll get into this, the AIA form contract, there's going to be a page where that chart will actually be in your contract, and it's not an uncommon thing. So as I was talking to you about how you're going to want to get some type of schedule, the chart will be based solely on your fees, part of the fee structure in the contract. And again, that chart that we put up had months, so there's also a schedule as far as timing of when we get them. But that will be something you will see consistently over and over. And so sometimes what you're going to find in a project is that maybe schematic, we had 20%, 20% I believe, so maybe the schematic phase you're going to shorten up a little bit. Some of the things, depending on what the owner wants or doesn't want, as far as the services you perform, will have you adjust your fees accordingly. So for example, there are many projects where you're going to do the schematic, the design development, the construction documents, but there will not be a formal bidding and negotiation phase in which you will be involved. It's a service that an architect can provide, and I think it's a very valuable service because by and large, the owner is unsophisticated in what's out and who these contractors are, whereas you're working with them every day. So an owner will try to save a little money and shave off a little bit from your fee by cutting out the bidding and negotiation phase. But one of the things you guys will want to think about is how you, and we're getting into the next part of this, is marketing. What services you can provide, what benefits and value added you can give to the owner by offering the your knowledge and your experience in the bidding negotiation phase. And that's where you can build some money back in and increase your fee. And it's a balance and a trade-off in educating your client if you can do that and being able to generate some more revenue. Another area, surprisingly, that you guys are going to find, especially in some of the smaller projects, certainly not in a large-scale multifamily residential or commercial, if you're working in hospitals or schools, those types of projects, it won't be cut out of that. But on smaller projects, sometimes they will actually cut out the last phase, which is called construction administration. And construction administration is where you guys will walk the job once a week to make sure that things are being performed, built in accordance with the plans and specs. Now, we'll get into classes later on. That actually can be one of the most dangerous places for you legally to be at risk. It's often a very small line item in the percentages of the 100% of your fees, that last item that was called construction, your administration fees. But again, some clients will say, we're just putting up a house, and I trust my builder, so I don't need you to charge me to walk my project site for 2 hours once a week. We're going to cut that out. Again, when we get into a little more marketing stuff in the second half of today's lecture, those are some things you'll learn to be able to tell your client where the value is added and help you generate some more fees. Any other questions?
Okay. Let's assume miracle happened, and you almost have a job. Big question is, as you see there, why would the client pick you as his architect? Let's assume for the house. Well, he picks you because he knows you. That's one way. He knows your work, whether he read about you or walked by a house you did, or an apartment building, or you were recommended by a builder. Usually contractors are good recommenders, but could be just a friend. Now, the first thing is that he knows you. What does that mean, he knows you? The more people you know, the more people will know you. Okay? You have to widen your acquaintance. You never know who will become a client. When I went to school, there was a textbook. I have not been able to find it. The title was, "You Never Refuse a Conversation with a Reputable Stranger." I have wonderful humorous drawings, architect babysitting, in order to do a house. But anyhow, how do you broaden your acquaintances? You belong to organizations. If you are a shy person who doesn't like to do that, leave marketing to somebody else. Have a partner who likes to do it. You have to not only belong to a lot of organizations, but you have to be active. You have to be noticed. You have to be able to get on the board. You know, if you are on the board of a church or some organization, and they know you are an architect, somebody somewhere in that organization will be recommending or needs an architect. And you are likely to be the person he or she will think of. But it's not enough to belong. You have to be active. Ideally, you get on the board. And you have to be, whatever little work you've done, you have to be written up. The classic example of that, in the city of Chicago, still practicing architect Stanley Tigerman. I knew Stanley, we were close friends from day one. We were close friends, now we are close enemies. Anyhow, that's another story. He hardly done any architecture work. He did a couple things without the client, a couple imaginary things, did some remodeling. He did all kinds of things to be written up. First of all, he drew extremely well. He used to draw and ink all the plans, elevations, renderings of these houses, whether they were imaginary or not. And every year, once a year minimum, sometimes twice, the beautiful prints of these drawings put together in an album, we went to see, went to New York, and went to see the editor of Architecture Record, Architecture Forum, Progressive Architecture, and showed them, took them out for lunch, and showed them what he's doing. Much of it at that time, you could consider was bullshit. They were imaginary projects, okay? Or very little insignificant projects, beautifully, beautifully inked and drawn up to catch the eye of editors. All these editors knew who Stanley Tigerman was. There are other ways to get known too, like Dick Baranczyk. He's an older man now, was a practicing architect. When I first came to Chicago, he became notorious making the front page of at that time Daily News. How? He beat up his mother-in-law. Now, that's not my recommendation. But he made the front page and became very notorious. So I don't say that by hook or crook you have to be in print, because that might be a criminal activity. But certainly, whatever you have done, and some of it is quite good, some of it might be mediocre, but beautifully presented, should be called to the attention of people who publish work, who spread your name. Well, in the beginning, you take any promising job. There is no no problem. You enter competitions. Now, I know competitions are risky, time-consuming, but there is one way you can create images of your own. You enter a competition, obviously you will develop beautiful drawings which print beautifully and will add to the portfolio you need to have. I don't know about architectural competitions right now, but I know, at least when I first got out of school, there was always one going on. Get involved with your profession, whether it's teaching opportunity, periodic lectures in the neighborhood organization, lectures at your church, opportunities to write articles, anything which puts your name to the attention of other people, eventually cannot help but help you.
If I could add a couple things, and I'll give you a recent story and then some things that back when I was in your seats. I don't know if any of you heard of this? This is a competition that was probably in the last 6-8 months. It was called the UN Competition. It was sponsored by the Art Institute of Chicago. Did you hear about this? So what it was, and this is, I tell you this because I was at a presentation of the UN Competition just last week. It was asking both architecture students and young people just recently out to give a 2-minute video presentation. Don't submit drawings. Don't submit models and your traditional competitions. But do 2 minutes of video of what you can do as far as design. And it was this wide open forum. It wasn't like we want a competition to design the new music hall in the city of Chicago, which you guys will never have in this stage of your careers an opportunity to do. That comes later when you work for a firm and you're on a team and everything else. But you guys wanting to figure out as students, A, how do I get a job? Or recently out there, now that I'm out here, how do I get more work? I'm working for this small little shop and I want to be able to make a name here or bring something in. So this uncompetition was quite interesting, and there were teams of two, and we got to see the 6 top winners at this presentation I was at. But the panel were local architects. There were people from AECOM. There were some very good architects that were there judging these people. The competition was all through actually Facebook. So when we were there, the presentation, the 2-minute video would be up, and then they Skyped in from these two women that were in literally the middle of a cornfield in Iowa where they lived. There was two women from Brooklyn. There was the actual winning cup team was a male-female from here. They were just from, I'm trying to remember what school they were at, but they were from Chicago, so they were actually with us. But what had happened was these people got something on the books, and it's something that they could add to their resume. And the team from Brooklyn had worked in their community, and they had talked to the community leaders about what can we do, and they actually, there was an area near where they lived where there had been 2 people shot and killed. And they wanted to transform this area into a garden as a memorial. And they knew they would never get the funds to build a fountain or some structure. So they actually went to the police station and they collected the disposable handcuffs, the nylon handcuffs, and they ended up making this beautiful lattice structure and used some wood and got involved in the community. And the presentation was just the first 2 trellises, but it's going to be this huge trellis that's going to cover this whole square block that they're getting now funding for. And these are 2 women that work for other architects, but they kind of started their own design firm on the side, not getting paid for it, but they're getting now recognition both in the city, the area of Brooklyn, and this national competition. The second place team, there was again 2 women that were the ones in the middle of the cornfield in Iowa, and they developed using claymation and bottles and things, if they had built a band shell in a nearby cornfield that the farmer had gone bankrupt, and they were trying to figure out how to reuse the land. Well, they went to the community leaders after they had made this thing, this uncompetition for us. And they pitched to the community leaders, and they got on board with an architect who was a practicing architect who can now certify the drawings. And they are now getting funding to build this band shell for the 3 local high school bands that would be able to play there. So this was an idea that started as a 2-minute video that has now gone in, and they will, these 2 women who are not licensed, but will be the design architects for the space and have been promised by the architect they're not going to work for him. But they promise to be involved every step of the way. Those are things that are what you guys can do in marketing. And when, so the other story real quickly, when I was in architecture school, I never entered into any competitions. You know, it was like we had too much work during the school year. In the summer, I wanted to, you know, I was a lifeguard. I liked to be out in the sun. I didn't want to spend my time on competitions. And I appreciate all that because you have plenty of time to work later. But the few of my friends that actually entered competitions during the school year in the summers when we were there, they all actually were able to secure jobs the earliest of us getting out because they had gone and had drawings that were that the industry recognizes as a professional action. It's not simply I'm walking in with my portfolio of the drawings I did while I was in school. I was up against A, B, and C, and some of them had won. There was actually one of my classmates did this furniture design. And then from that, he actually got a scholarship at Sorbonne and went over and spent and did graduate school at the Sorbonne because of his competition with the furniture. Another one of my classmates won Paris Prize. Again, it was money that they could get to go on to further education. And all of those are used at your level of your career for marketing to get yourselves jobs and further on later in down the line.
Okay. Have to get up. Anyhow. Let's assume that the miracle happened. It's a miracle that you got a job, right? You have a terribly difficult problem as a beginning practitioner to decide what fee to charge, okay? Figuring fees, okay, that's the next page. Okay. That's my competition. You can read that or listen to me. Either way, it's probably the same. Anyhow, what fee to charge? One way to charge would be percentage of the construction cost. Obviously, let's assume you would want to do that, which I don't recommend, but let's assume. You know, it's not a straight line, it's a curve. Because the more expensive the job, the percentage needs to go down. Clients are generally unhappy with percentage fee. There is an ethical issue always involved. If you get a percentage of the construction cost, a priori, you suspect, because the more the building will cost, the more money you make. They simply don't trust you. And I agree. I don't think architecture fees should be based on a percentage of the construction cost. There is a tremendous ethical issue involved, where you get more money the higher the bids. It's, in my opinion, it's a wrong way to charge, but it's a wrong way to the client and for the architect. It's much easier to do a lump sum contract. To do a lump sum contract, you have to watch, however. And let's assume you figure this job out. It's a $12 million job, and you need a fee of, I don't know, $120,000, whatever figure fee you want. But what happens is the scope, as the job progresses, changes. Take an apartment building. It's a straight shot, right? Nothing is straighter. Typical floor repeated 25 times. The only difference is the community room, lobby, management offices. It's very little non-programmed space. Yes, that's wonderful. And let's assume it's X million dollars, and you agreed to a lump sum fee. And during construction, they decide that they will add a swimming pool on the third floor. You can't turn them down. How does that come into the equation? You have more engineering work, for planning work, maybe two or three sheets of working drawings. It's to agree to a lump sum fee. You have to define, and you cannot do it yet in drawing, verbally. You have to define the scope of your project. Whether you can do it or not, your attorney can do it. You have to define how you will handle changes, because there always are changes. Any client who says there will be no changes is bullshitting you. There will be changes, and you better be protected to define how to handle additive changes, because it's not anymore, your fee is not tied to the construction cost, so you have to have some kind of rate, hourly rate, to take care of changes. An hourly rate which is defined within time limits, because you know a job, the design of an apartment building and the construction can drag on anywhere from 3 to 6, 7 years. You never know. Economy slows down, client's mother-in-law dies, what the hell knows? You have to be protected. You have to deal with inflation. So all of that protection should be built into your lump sum contract with the cooperation of your attorney. The problem with hourly rates, anybody who will advocate hourly rates is going to be a little bit suspect by clients, because hourly rate seems to, well, it does, reward incompetence. The longer you sit on your ass and do those drawings, the more money you make, as against the guy who can grind it out fast, if something is unfair. And you should be able to spend as much time as you wish on any part of the drawing or building without being suspected that you are trying to increase your reward. The best thing is a lump sum contract, and for extras, you have a rate schedule which you date and put a time limit on, say it's end to the end of the year. If inflation is heavy, then the time limit is up, you are entitled to change it. There is another way to figure architectural fee, and many times the city of Chicago, I don't know whether it's true or not, like to do that, is to use a multiplier. Say, pay you 2.5 times payroll. The big problem is, what is payroll? Payroll is not just the money you pay the guy, but the money you pay for Social Security, the money you pay for insurance. So all the benefits should be included in the payroll. If they ask you to give in this contract a rate of pay, you can do that. You know, partners, well, I don't know, 120 to 150 an hour. Job captain, 75, 80, all the way down to draftsman, $35 to $50 an hour. But again, it should be renewable. It should be time limited to give you the chance to work toward inflation. Averaging is a dangerous thing, to say so many dollars an hour. If it was all spent for somebody who's getting $150 an hour and you get only 80, you're screwed. If on the other hand the person only gets 30, you took advantage of the client. In all cases, you should be knowledgeable enough to know your production costs to avoid being bankrupt.
So if I took the contracts that I negotiated for my architecture clients, I would say 80 to 90% of them are on what we call a lump sum. So what happens is you get the project, you get called by the owner, and you and three other architects, and you're asked to bid the job. And what you'll do is you'll take the phases that we talked about before, and you'll do an estimate knowing that the project is roughly $10 million. And you'll try to determine how many man hours are going to go into the various phases. And what your, if you remember that $61.39 figure or whatever it was, what your break-even point is. And so you factor in those, you take the first few slides that we had today, you factor those in, and then you bid the project on a lump sum, so it's your all-in number. That's the majority of the contracts we see. If you're going to do this percentage of construction cost concept, which is the first thing up there, that will be the same calculation, your same analysis, but you'll convert that actual dollar figure of what you need to generate into a percentage. But as John has said, you are going to find that an owner wanting to manage its costs and looking at the first place where it believes it can shave costs will be to keep you at a fixed fee, because the owner wants to establish his budget, as opposed to a percentage. The reason why is what John was talking about, the point up there about change orders. Do you guys all know what a change order is? Change order is, real briefly, is when the project, something is different than the original assumptions. Now that could be the owner putting on a four-bedroom house and changes his mind and wants five bedrooms. So he changed the scope. The scope was a four-bedroom house, it became a five-bedroom. That's after the contracts have been signed with the architect and the contractor. So you draft what's called a change order. It is an actual document that has dollars and terms on it describing the change. And that becomes part of the contract. It can happen for anything. Now that's an owner-directed change. Sometimes you go in there and you start digging a hole and you realize that underground there's a utility pipe that nobody knew that existed. It needs to be removed. That's a change order that needs, because the contractor has to incur more costs to do this work. So those happen on every project. And an average change order percentage in commercial construction is roughly 10%. So your $1 million project, by and large, is going to come in at $1.1 million. So the point that we made here, legally, is you need to write into your contract some type of mechanism that protects you if, as a result of the fifth bedroom, or as a result of this pipe that's found underground, or whatever change in the scope occurs, that you're compensated for that. So again, back to the most common models, if it's a percentage, whatever the value of that fifth bedroom adds to the price of the house, you get that percentage. And the owners sometimes aren't happy with that, because you may not do much more in the drawings, and you get another kicker. If it's going to be a lump sum, do you go in and negotiate after the fact, fifth bedroom, you were going to pay me $100,000, I need another $10,000 for these drawings because you've gone down and you've done all your math, like you did your calculations, how many man hours are you getting? Or another way, and this is again probably the most common, is there's the lump sum as your base bid, and then you write a paragraph that says, if there are scope changes, all additional services related to that will be paid on an hourly fee, and that's this hourly schedule we have up here, principal, et cetera, et cetera. So the owner knows going in, when they add that fifth bedroom, you're going to put somebody on the actual clock, and the 2 hours by the principal, and the 7 hours by the captain, and those types of people will come and they'll see in the bill on an hourly wage. So now you'll be getting your $100,000 for your services, plus this extra. And then the last point that I think that John was making as far as date your fee schedule. this is the fee schedule for 2012. And put into the contract that the fee schedule will be renewed annually on January 1. And the owner may find himself trying to scramble to get some services for you done in November, December. The other thing you would want to do is that this is in a larger commercial project. And I have written this in for architects, as well as having to negotiate on owner's behalf. Say, for example, one of my clients is Trinity University. They were on a capital campaign to raise money to build a new student center. They wanted to sign up the architects because they needed to get budgets. So they needed to get some initial schematic designs and design development so they could go out and send it for budgets, limited, no construction documents, and then go back to the alumni and say, we need to raise this $12 million. Well, the time frame from doing schematic and design development to when they get the $12 million that they can greenlight the construction documents and actually building the building has now been 3 years. They don't have the money yet. There's all different ways where the revenue is supposed to go, and this happens with every capital project for private institutions. So in the contract, what was written, not only was the fee schedule written on an annual basis, but there was a 36-month hold on the lump sum price. So the architect said, I will do the design services for you for X hundreds of thousands of dollars. If you can't get funding within 36 months of us executing this contract, we're going to renegotiate the price. Sometimes you want to do 12 months, sometimes 24. That's all part of the negotiation. But what it does, going back to inflation, making sure you can run your business, is if you book this client and this project with the concept that you're going to make $300,000 in 2012, and that's the whole project, and come March, they say, we're putting a hold on it. You don't have any revenue, but you want to be able to lock that in later on. So there's different ways you can use these models and put in protections, such as rate schedule on an annual basis, lump sum, or percentages on a renewable basis that they have to rechange. Those are ways to protect yourself and make sure the contract goes forward. And the best thing about all of this is, and this is what we'll harp on the rest of the semester, the contract is going to be your best friend, because the more you have in writing, it's the rules of monopoly. It's how you play the game. It's in there in writing. So when something goes wrong or something changes, like they find this pipe underground, you know what to do next. And you don't have to call me and incur the fees from me. You guys can work it out.
Well, let me put it this way. I never regretted calling the lawyer. Actually, my attorney, his partners, and I were best friends. I used the attorney quite a bit. I'll tell you why in a minute. The issues to settle, you know, what is included or not included in the fee, when is it being paid, there is anything of reimbursables, printing costs, travel expense, everything, that should be defined. There are very, very special cases, such as reuse rights. What happens, you did an apartment building, very successful, client buys a piece of property, a large enough piece, it's somewhere in the suburb, and he wants to build another building. And he goes ahead, starts construction without contacting you, without making an agreement. I mean, you are being royally screwed. He has a prince. This set of prints should be limited to one building. There is no right to reuse. Your very best bet that when you have a contract, contact with a potential client, after basic agreements, call your attorney. whatever it costs was the best spent money. Now, do you always need a contract? I can foresee some cases where a handshake is enough to start. Rarely is it enough. Do we always need a formal contract? An AIA contract form would be the nicest way to do it. Is a letter enough if it's the right letter at the right time with the supervision of your attorney? It's a possibility. You know, it all depends on human beings. I remember one job I had, the name of the developer was Manny Sklar. S-K-L-A-R, Manny Sklar. He owned the Sahara Motel. The Sahara Motel was near O'Hare Field, the three-story concrete block and poor concrete building. It was doing extremely well. He wanted to add a kind of an auditorium, a stage for big traveling events. He came to the office and he asked me, what would you charge? I said, 6%. You got a deal. Like this. You have a contract for me to sign? I said, wait, wouldn't you like me to have it sent to your attorney to look at? He says, screw the attorneys. I sign it, or I don't sign it. So I ran out to my secretary. I said, this is his name, address of the job, described very, two sentences, prepare a contract, 6%, 6%. I never had a smoother contract. I should have been worried. I should have been worried because while I was talking to my secretary, he went in the conference room, was making a telephone call, and he says, you son of a bitch, you will find yourself in the trunk of a car. I should have been worried about that. Anyhow, to cut a long story short, Manny Sklar paid his bills like a gentleman. The working drawings were about two-thirds completed, and Manny Sklar made the front page of the Tribune because he badmouthed the mafia. He was one of the mafia men and made some comments in near North Bars. To cut a long story short, they didn't like it. The boys didn't like it. So Manny, one evening, was walking home in 3200, whatever, North Lakeshore Drive, an apartment building, and as he was walking from the parking garage where he left the car to the door, the car pulls by and machine gunned him down. That was the end of my job. And at that time he owed me $60,000. And I told my partner, Bob Hausner, I'm going to put a lien on the son of a bitch, the property. He says, they will finish you. Don't do that. I said, who will finish me? He says, the mafia. He says, so I started to be worried. And I got worried. One Friday night, I happened to go to synagogue, and two guys are talking in the lobby, and he says, you know, that son of a bitch, Manny Sklar, tried to screw me. I put a lien on his property. He was a supplier of China. And then another guy says, I did too. He was a supplier of some food, potatoes, whatever. So I figured, those two guys are putting a lien. They are not going to kill all of us. So I put on the lien on the property. A week later, I get a call from Marshall Savings and Loan. Would I accept less than 60? I said, certainly. how would I accept $40,000? I said, I accept. I ran back to the office and Bob Hausner said, why did you give up, blew up $20,000? I said, it's a judgment call. He got the $40,000. 3 days later, I read the paper, Marshall Savings and Loan went under. After I cashed the check. So you get all kinds of clients. Anybody who uses your phone and promises the guy on the end of the line that he'll find himself in the trunk of his car, watch out. Anyhow, issues. Issues of contract. You know, you not only have contact with your client, you also have contact with your engineering associates. It is extremely important that you, vis-a-vis the engineers, have the same relation as vis-a-vis the client. You have to know what the engineers charge. You have to know what they include. They include the same kind of field visit what you obligated yourself to during construction. What is the rate of pay? Must be the same as yours. The same contract condition. Are they covered by insurance? All of this. You want to have settled in writing. And before I conclude, let me tell you a story of my feeling about insurance. It's an absolute rotten necessity. You can't exist without it. You need to have insurance. I am not sure this is always true. If you have nothing, they won't sue you. If you don't have an office, you don't have a home, you don't have a car, you can put all of that under your wife's name, make sure you are faithful, they will not sue you. You know, I mean, you cannot sue somebody who has nothing to give. Anyway, I'm suggesting that you do that. It's a comfortable feeling to have the insurance. Anyhow, I enjoy talking to you. I wish you well. This is your last year, right? You start looking for it. How many of you have working already? Small? On your own? Not yet. In a small firm. Yes. Don't practice before getting your license. Anyhow, if anybody has questions, either myself or my colleague will answer it, if we can. I'm sure you can.
Does anybody have any questions? If we could thank John for coming, I'd appreciate it.
Anytime.
He will be back later this semester to talk a little bit more about practice and performance as he's going. We hope you got some good insight from John. Thank you.
Thank you for paying attention. Okay. Oh, you're going to...